Glenn Greenwald, who reported Edward Snowden's revelations about government surveillance, told NPR's Morning Edition today that since 9/11, the National Security Agency's ability to intercept communications has grown too vast and powerful beyond its mission to prevent attacks. Greenwald has written a book. It's in release this week. So too is a new documentary about the NSA from Frontline on PBS. It's called United States of Secrets. And its producer, investigative journalist Michael Kirk, joins us this hour as we get up to date on the latest revelations about the NSA. The nation is still engaged in a debate about how far we go to protect the country from attacks while preserving what remains of our privacy. Please stay tuned for the discussion after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us for the second hour of today's show. On a flight to Hong Kong, the attorney, blogger, and Guardian columnist Glenn Greenwald was handed a flash drive containing thousands of classified documents that revealed the extent of the U.S. government's domestic spying program. Greenwald was on his way to meet his then-anonymous source, Edward Snowden. Greenwald had been receiving cryptic emails for a while up to this point and was skeptical of their legitimacy, but upon scanning these documents, he realized that he had a significant news story on his hands. What Snowden gave Greenwald were internal documents that outlined what is known as the program, capital T, capital P, unprecedented domestic surveillance that was set in motion by Vice President Dick Cheney immediately following the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, September 11, 2001. It was Vice President Cheney's move to get as much power and information into the hands of the White House as possible in an attempt to prevent further terrorist attacks. Cheney started with the CIA, whose officials then consulted the National Security Agency, the nation's largest and most secretive intelligence agency based at Fort Meade, Maryland. In the Bush administration, the NSA was given the authority to ignore previous legal restrictions and move forward on the biggest surveillance program in history. The program managed to stay secret for some time, and data was being collected with little intrusion, despite objections from members of the Department of Justice, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and members of Congress. Nonetheless, the New York Times caught wind of the program, and finally in 2005 it published a story about warrantless wiretapping of U.S. citizens. But it was last year's document leak from NSA contract employee Edward Snowden that revealed the magnitude of the surveillance program. Today on Midday, we take a look at the history of the program with investigative journalist Michael Kirk, producer of part one of a two-part documentary, United States of Secrets, which debuts on PBS's Frontline tomorrow night, May 13th. The second part airs May 20th. The documentary tracks the government's domestic surveillance program from September 11th, 2001, to the present. It's an in-depth outline of the events and people that made this level of internal spying, domestic spying, a possibility through secrecy, intimidation, and fear. We're also joined today on the program by Michael Greenberger, law professor at the University of Maryland's Carey School of Law and director of the University of Maryland's Center for Health and Homeland Security. He's been with us on the show before to talk about these issues, and we welcome him back. Michael Greenberger, nice to see you again.
Good to see you, Dan.
And Michael Kirk, we welcome you to Midday on WYPR in Baltimore. Thanks for making time for us.
It's terrific of you to invite me. Thank you.
Yep. Your documentary, this takes us back, takes me back anyway, to that story in 2005 of the New York Times. But we've learned so much since then, since the first revelations about the warrantless searching and domestic spying. And I say domestic spying, some people may think that the NSA's focus has been on, you know, foreign intelligence activities overseas. But it's pretty clear by now that since 9/11, domestic spying has come back.
Once upon a time, there was at the NSA, for the 20,000 employees who worked at Fort Meade, a bright white line painted that had been painted there in the 70s, as Michael can tell you all about. And the line said, "Use your eyes and ears on the world, but never point it at Americans again," under penalty of committing a felony. Once 9/11 happened, the amazing thing, I think, about this story is how quickly people, good people, hardworking people out at the NSA, turned from that rule and found themselves gathering information on Americans and the rest of the world in such a fashion, and at the same time, maybe the darkest secret America has ever had was kept in under lock and key in the vice president's attorney's office, David Addington's office, and on the top deck at the NSA in Mike Hayden's office.
I don't mind going back, stepping into the 1970s just for a moment for a point of history for our listeners, that during the Nixon years and coming out of the Nixon years, there were all these hearings in Washington, Michael Greenberger, about what the CIA was up to in terms of domestic spying or the NSA, the intelligence community in general. And it was happening during the Vietnam War. Protesters were being spied upon, others during the Nixon years.
Yeah, Martin Luther King as a primary example.
Yeah, right, another one.
You're right that during the 70s, there were several investigations on Congress. The most prominent one was by the Church Committee, headed by Idaho Democratic Senator Frank Church. And they recommended a program that allowed administration only when it got a warrant from the newly created Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court to do eavesdropping on U.S. citizens if they fit into a certain category. The unilateral investigation of U.S. citizens was out of bounds. That was what the Church Committee established using the Nixon years as an example of the abuses of uncontrolled, unsupervised intelligence on U.S. citizens. So as Michael says, when he introduces the story, by the way, I had an opportunity to see it. I hope that's okay. I was read into the program.
Oh, yeah.
It is fantastic. It is a fantastic program. I flatter myself in thinking I know a lot about this, and I learned a lot from this documentary, and I highly recommend it. But anyway, as Michael makes clear in the program, the Frontline program, that after 9/11, this bright line between only looking outside the United States at foreign operatives as opposed to inside the United States dissipated, and that created a big controversy even within the Bush administration. And I think one of the nice things about this documentary, it points out that this debate was really among Bush government officials. There were Jack Goldsmith, for example, who was the Assistant Secretary of the Office of Legal Counsel, was a very prominent conservative, member of the Federal Society, and he took the lead in challenging the lawfulness of the program. So it wasn't the ACLU arguing with the Bush administration. These were a lot of conservative NSA people, conservative staff members in Congress, conservative members of Congress, who felt this was an unlawful incursion by the NSA.
Michael Kirk, did the idea come from Cheney, or was it Cheney and his staff, his own attorney?
In order to understand Cheney and his relationship to all of this, you have to go back just for a second to Iran-Contra and when he was a congressman, a Wyoming congressman. He was on the staff. He was on a committee that was listening to all the arguments, and he formed an alliance with David Addington, a staff attorney there. They both shared a common belief in what has now become known as executive power, the idea that there was a sort of dominant power built into the original ideas of the framers, that the executive branch would take the lead and that the secondary branches were the Congress and the courts. Cheney and Addington both believed that in a modern presidency, it was more and more incumbent that the president of the United States be able to act kind of unilaterally. And certainly when the opportunity presented itself, and I think they even may have thought of it as an opportunity and the obligation, let's give them that too, to do something quickly, efficiently, without the cumbersome nature of congressional debate or court approval, they, in that bunker that very day, Cheney asks for his attorney, David Addington, to come to be let back downstairs. And they sit there and they discuss very quickly what they're going to need to do to organize the kind of power the president of the United States is going to need in order to stop further attacks. Nobody knew what was going to happen. Remember, both towers had dropped and the Pentagon had been hit. Mm-hmm. And Cheney and Addington already were planning how to use this opportunity to create authorities for President Bush so that he would be able to confront what everybody, many people thought there may be sleeper cells. Nobody really knew what was happening in America at the time. He wanted rules that were not cumbersome, and that very quickly migrated to the Central Intelligence Agency, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the National Security Agency.
We've learned some things about what the FBI knew and when it knew it prior to 9/11. The NSA was taken totally by surprise. Is that part of the reason for this reaction, because the NSA just was unaware that this attack was going to happen?
Well, you know, they, like everybody who was getting read into the threat matrix and other things, knew that there was there were worries about an asymmetrical opponent out there, that Al-Qaeda existed, that bin Laden existed. President Clinton had tried to, as we say, get him with a cruise missile once. So they knew that the threat was out there, but they were many inside the agency felt hamstrung, one hand tied behind their back because of the prohibitions that Michael and I have talked about that obtained at the agency at the time. The guilt, if you can only imagine, these are what we used to call pocket protector people. They're crypto scientists, crypto mathematicians and linguists. They're extremely intelligent and patriotic people who suddenly this horrible thing happens in America, and their job is to prevent it. They were created, after all, in the shadow of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. They really believe that this was their responsibility. And I think inside, many of them that we talked to believe that they knew the guilt that was with them that day, because they knew that probably somewhere inside their computers, their vast networks, there was information about this that they hadn't accessed because they hadn't been aggressively plugging into the web and other sources of information. And in fact, within hours, let's say a day or a day and a half, they knew that there was a set of phone calls from a safe house in Yemen that had come to San Diego that had, if they had been able to follow it, tap it, follow the call from the subsequent calls from San Diego, they might have been able to get to people on the East Coast who were the hijackers. Mm-hmm. They knew very quickly that hijackers were living in a motel just outside of the NSA, in the shadow of the NSA. They knew that they'd been to an ADT or an
ATM.
ATM. Thank you very much. So much for acronyms. Too many acronyms in the story. Anyway, ATM machines. And they had also intercepted some communications that said things like, the game is on, tomorrow's the big day. So they inside there was a kind of soul searching and a mixed with revenge, mixed with a guilt that they had missed it and that they never wanted to miss it again.
The NSA director at the time was General Michael Hayden, correct?
Yes, Michael Hayden, former Air Force general who, mm-hmm. He was an existing Air Force general, 3-star at the time, became 4-star over the time, and had come in 1999 to what was a technologically moribund agency. The NSA was way behind the Silicon Valley curve, and they knew it at one time. They'd been in the lead of all of these things, and in the 90s, they'd really fallen off their game. And one of Hayden's jobs was to try to perk it all up again. And in hearing after hearing in the late 90s, you can hear him trying to argue for upgrading, for lack of a better word, the techniques and technologies of the NSA. And it was Hayden's task, the very moment that 9/11 happened, to once again perk up the place, for lack of a more efficient description, in the face of the crisis.
This is an excerpt from United States of Secrets, General Michael Hayden, then director of the NSA, reflecting on a conversation he had with his wife after getting approval to go ahead with the domestic surveillance program. Prior to this, of course, the NSA had been more limited in what it could do. Here's what Michael Hayden has to say in United States of Secrets.
And she said, "What's on your mind?" I said, "Well, we're going to go do something here." And I didn't go into any details. "We're going to do something. One day it's going to be public. And when it gets public, it's going to be very controversial. And the people doing it are going to be swept into this thing." And she said, "Huh? Is it the right thing to do?" I said, "Yeah, I think so." She said, "Okay. We'll deal with that when it comes."
Now, Hayden had been told by the CIA director, George Tenet, to go ahead with this, right? So this is a conversation he's having with his wife about what he's been told he can go ahead and do now.
Well, Tenet calls him. Tenet has a meeting with the vice president right after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And the vice president and David Addington say to him, "You got to take the gloves off. This is a pernicious enemy. We don't exactly know everything about him. You guys at the CIA better get going on this." And Tenet was happy to hear that because he wanted a way for the CIA to make up for some past sins. So he was very eager to get them into the fight in Afghanistan and other places. Tenet also calls Mike Hayden and says to Hayden that he's been talking to the vice president and they wondered what Hayden could do to spruce up the approach of the NSA. And Hayden said, "Well, there's lots of things I could probably do, but I don't think I really have the authorities to do them because they probably involve spying on Americans. And so I don't really have the authority to do that." And Tenet, allegedly, according to Hayden, says to Hayden, "That wasn't exactly the question I asked you." And Hayden gets the message that what he's expected to do is take the gloves off out at the NSA and get more aggressive. And that's what he says to his closest staff members. "Let's bring me some plans that push the envelope." And a couple days later, he's invited down for his very first meeting ever to the Oval Office. He walks in. The president has been briefed about him and that he'd never met him before. And Andy Card tells us, the chief of staff of the president, tells us the president might not have even known who Mike Hayden was. And Card wasn't sure if he'd ever heard his name before. And in walks General Hayden, the head of the NSA, now finally on the guest list at the Oval Office. And the president puts his arm around him and calls him his kindergarten nickname, Mikey.
Wow.
And it's at that moment that the president says
Mikey.
He believes he can unilaterally authorize whatever Hayden may be worried about in terms of the legal aspects of the program. And it's that Hayden returns back to Fort Meade, takes the drive back with his heart in his throat, no doubt, and decides to take a walk with his wife and let her know, if not the specific details, the broad guidelines of what is ahead for him for the next 4 years.
Michael Kirk, producer of the part one of the two-part documentary, United States of Secrets for Frontline, and Michael Greenberger. So now we have, up to this point, we're going to take our first break, the President of the United States secretly authorizing the NSA to eavesdrop on Americans and to capture more evidence of terrorist activities through domestic spying, basically, right? He's authorized the NSA director to do that.
Yes, he has. And the one thing that the documentary brings out, however, is that the underlying theory is the president has the unilateral power to do that. What you mean by that is that he's not going to a court, because traditionally when you do this kind of surveillance, you have to go to a court and get some kind of warrant. So they were completely avoiding that. But the interesting thing about it was the program required the consent, the affirmative consent of the attorney general. So that sort of made it nice. The president's exercising his unilateral constitutional authority, and the attorney general is attesting that he has this authority by signing the orders, which are revived every 45 days. And of course, the drama really comes in this documentary, as I'm sure Michael will go into in greater detail, when people inside the Justice Department, new people come in who are conservatives, by the way, mm-hmm. saying he doesn't have this authority and there's real problems here. It's not just the problem of not going to a court. It's that the bulk collection of this information, which we live with arguably today, is they're getting everything, whether you're a suspected terrorist or not. They're getting all this information and then culling it. And that's troublesome to a lot of people because they're subject, in a sense, to the kind of general warrant that the Fourth Amendment was supposed to defeat. And what these conservatives are saying, no, you need to have something that targets people. You just can't go look or collect everybody's information.
Michael Greenberger, professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law and director of the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security, joining us in this hour of midday for our conversation with Michael Kirk, producer of, as I said, the part one of a two-part documentary, United States of Secrets, which airs on Frontline, PBS, tomorrow night. The second part, May 20th. If you have questions about this, you'd like to join our conversation, make a comment about the National Security Agency and all that we've learned since the revelations from Edward Snowden via Glenn Greenwald. And Glenn Greenwald is also in this documentary. He is out with a book himself this week, and certainly Frontline doing its part to edify the public about this program, actually called The Program. 410-662-8780, the midday email address, midday@wypr.org. Welcome back to Midday. Michael Kirk joining us this hour, producer of part one of a two-part documentary, United States of Secrets, which airs on Frontline tomorrow night, on PBS tomorrow night, May 13th. And the second part, we'll tell you about that, the second part a little bit later in this hour, airs on May 20th. And Michael Greenberger with us from the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security. I just want to clear something up about Glenn Greenwald, Edward Snowden, and the program that we've been discussing called The Program, right, which goes back to 9-11. The revelations that we got, Michael Kirk, from Edward Snowden via Glenn Greenwald had a lot to do with the metadata collection. We spent a lot of time talking about that, the capture of huge amounts of phone call, telephonic records, and internet records, right? To what extent did we learn from Edward Snowden more about the program that we're discussing here, the actual NSA's domestic spying?
The first thing to remember is that there were three reporters who received
a
tremendous amount of stuff from Edward Snowden. There's Bart Gellman from The Washington Post, mm-hmm. And Laura Poitras, a documentary filmmaker, but much more than that, too, who worked with The Guardian newspaper in Britain and in New York. Mm-hmm. Ewan McCaskill, a sort of editor but a senior presence at The Guardian, was also in Hong Kong and part of the whole process as well. The most important thing to remember about Snowden, it seems to me, having done this film for the last 6 months and having thought hard about the sort of basic fundamental question, is what did he actually do and why did he do it? Snowden watched from a distance. Snowden grew up in your radio range. Mm-hmm. A young kid, high school dropout, is part of that army of young people who are computer savvy and get swept up in the thirst of the program for foot soldiers who work on computers, who handle data. He's for a time at the CIA and then at the NSA and then an NSA contractor in Japan and Hawaii. Snowden is at some moment becomes really the first whistleblower ever who, it seems like, he takes the job, the Hawaii job, so that he can gather information and leak it. And he does this partly because he's read an inspector general's report, a draft inspector general report from the NSA that basically is the history of what happened. It's the things you and I and Michael Greenberger are talking about here, all laid out, because there are, in a mysterious way, Michael Greenberger will appreciate this, there are no contemporaneous notes, no paper from any of the early days of who said what to whom at the Oval Office, in the Vice President's office, at the NSA. It's all either gone or never recorded. So what you have in the IG report is the testimony, the sworn testimony, of people like Michael Hayden and many others, which we also have in our film because we've interviewed all the people that were there. But at the time when it was the deepest, darkest secret America had ever had, and Edward Snowden had access as a super user to the computers that had everything, he comes across this IG report, reads it, reads the history, and says, oh my God, there's illegality going on in the government and no one is being punished except the whistleblowers. And he determines to gather enough information to actually get a kind of drip, drip, drip going in America so that there will be a debate about this. This is his avowed intention. I'm not endorsing it one way or the other. And what he does when he watches everything closely is he hears about NSA whistleblowers like Thomas Drake and Bill Binney and Kurt Wiebe and Ed Loomis and Diane Rourke from Congress. And he says, and these are all sort of conservative Americans. These are not radical liberals. He says none of their efforts yielded anything but indictments and trouble for them. So I've got to do something. And none of the reporting, none of the New York Times stories, none of the Baltimore Sun stories ever actually generated much interest among the public in America. Public polls show that most people weren't very concerned about their privacy being invaded in the aftermath of the New York Times story and others. So he says, I'm not only going to take part of the problem was those stories didn't have legs because they didn't have paper. I'm going to deliver, according to the government, 1.7 million pages of paper, and it's going to be carefully aggregated paper. He intentionally picked certain things and handed it out to Bart Gellman, Laura, and Glenn, and Ewan McCaskill and The Guardian. I think, I don't know what the method to it was, but I know that whatever we've seen so far, the PRISM documents, the Muscular documents, other things, are just the beginning of what I believe is going to come rolling out for years to come. That was the original idea of Snowden. I'm going to be better than the other leakers. I'm going to have more, and I'm going to take myself out of the equation as much as possible by being completely transparent about who I am and what I do. And I'm just going to make the information king here and let people receive it through newspapers and blogs and movies and everything, every other way they can, and let's get the debate going about who actually was committing potentially illegal acts and how much was actually being accumulated. And I have the feeling, you guys, I'm not certain of this, but I'm pretty certain that there's a lot more to come, and that what we've seen is, if maybe not the tip of the iceberg, it's not all of the iceberg, and this is going to continue as a big story, I think, for a long, long time.
I want to go to what is illegal, the question about what is illegal, what in terms of what happened here with the program. Okay, so I want to understand, and I want our listeners to understand how it worked. What did Bush actually authorize the NSA to do? Is the fact that the Bush authorized the NSA to conduct any kind of domestic surveillance in itself illegal? Or was authorization to the NSA through the FISA court, was that ostensibly legal?
Well, the domestic surveillance in the absence of a judicial sanction, right, whether it be a regular court or the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, that was thought to be illegal.
And warrantless surveillance is illegal.
And the documentary points that out very clearly, that the conservatives in Congress, in the Justice Department, are very concerned that this is unilateral, that the executive branch itself is deciding who it's going to surveil. And they believe you have to go to a court. And by the way, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act set up just such a court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which, as the documentary demonstrates, is in a highly secret room in the Justice Department that was used during the Cold War so that people couldn't overhear their lessons.
Right.
That's one thing. The second thing is, and I think this is something I got out of this, was that the bulk collection, which is going to all the telephone carriers and saying, we want every American's records of who they called and how long they were on that phone call. And it develops worse to that, which makes the story too complicated to talk about here, that you're getting everybody's records. And I think as this story has come out, both through this documentary and through the media pertaining to the Snowden thing, the Americans have really rebelled against the fact that every time they make a phone call, the NSA is going to have that information.
I would like to hear more of that, actually. I'll put out the phone number again. I frankly, on this show, I have not. The number of times we've addressed this topic since Snowden's revelations, primarily, I haven't heard it. I haven't heard it enough expressed, I think, for me to be convinced that people are still that concerned. Maybe I'm just listening to the wrong people or listening for the wrong people, or maybe you shouldn't go by what you hear on talk radio.
Well, I don't want to rob too much of Michael Kirk's time, but
yeah.
There's legislation plowing through Congress to correct
exactly.
a lot of this
I understand
stuff.
Now there
and
is.
And that wouldn't be plowing through Congress if the American public was not up in arms about
well,
it.
Well, let's hear from our listeners at 410-662-8780. I remember Congressman Dutch Ruppersberger changing his tune on this.
Yes.
Originally saying, in order to find a needle in the haystack, you have to have the haystack.
But he changed.
He's changed his tune on it. So maybe you're right. He's hearing from his constituents. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here if you'd like to join us. So Bush basically said to the NSA, go ahead and collect what you want, listen to everything anywhere, and listen for suspicious activity. Is that about accurate, Michael Kirk?
Yes. I mean, in essence, if you boil down what he said, they're going to gather the data on phone records and internet traffic of hundreds of millions of Americans and then search it for suspicious connections, right? In other words, if you're looking for unknown conspirators, the way they devised to do that was look at everybody, right? That was the theory of it, where we know there's the odd needle in the haystack or needle within the needles, but in order to figure out which one it is, we're just going to get everything and we'll go back and figure it out later.
I wanted to ask you about Thin Thread, this phrase or the name of a project called Thin Thread, because because you've mentioned Thomas Drake. You made a reference to the Baltimore Sun. This is a story I was familiar with that appeared in the Baltimore Sun back in 2006. So if you don't mind, Michael Kirk, let's go over this a little bit. What was Thin Thread?
Thin Thread was back in before, now we're before 9/11, so let's say we're in 99, mm-hmm. a group of scientists down in a skunk works at the Fort Meade were looking for ways to do, in effect, what they knew Silicon Valley was fixing to do. They were going to gather groups of people who had similar interests and similar connections. They were going to basically do the 6 degrees of separation from Kevin Bacon thing or whatever it is. And they were going to but they were going to do it for the whole world. And they figured out how to do it. Now, in order to do it for the whole world, you have to do it about Americans. So, and I'm really being broad here in my definition of thin thread. I hope if any of them are listening, they'll forgive me. But the idea, they came up with a sort of elegant way to do the world, and then they needed to do America. And in order to do that, somebody created the word anonymize. They needed to encrypt. They'd grab data in the United States from a lot of the web head-ins that are all over America, and they would, and it would be American email, telephone, everything else data, but it would be encrypted in a way that you could know if that call came from that safe house in Yemen to someplace in the United States. And you could then go get with, but you didn't know who would receive the call or anything about their data, which was all encrypted. No analyst at the NSA could ever penetrate it without a FISA court warrant. So you could go forward and say, we know in Yemen that house is, you know, a safe house. We know it called a place in San Diego, and we have that information. Who that is, what that is, judge, could we have an authorization to go open it up? And if the judge said yes, then you opened it up, and then you could chase very quickly everybody that had ever been called by the San Diego number and theoretically build a matrix and go say, all right, these are the people that are suspects, and we're going to go surveil them. That was the idea of Thin Thread. It lost in two ways. First, it lost in 1999 when the attorneys from the National Security Agency, who were still very wary of breaking any laws that had been established in FISA, they said, no, we can't have it. It gets American data. We can't get to the American data. That was the first thing that stopped it. The second thing was it became part of some kind of a, we didn't spend much time, although Siobhan Gorman in the Sun did, and it's worth reading, that there was a kind of inside the NSA, a feeling that they needed a bigger, flashier, showier program that could involve lots of contractors, and therefore what happened, of course, was that there was lots of waste and maybe even some graft and other things that were associated with it. And so within the NSA, Thin Thread gets buried in this morass of two kinds of things that are going on. The Thin Thread team, unhappy after 9/11, especially when they can't get Thin Thread back in the fight in any way, discovers that there is another bigger, grander program underway, and that the best parts of Thin Thread are in there, but not the protection parts. They've been stripped out, and that's when they worry about illegality and say we can't be part of a criminal process. They begin to climb the chain of command, trying to tell people don't do this, don't do this, and when they fail at that. Three of them, the three Thin Thread members, Bill Binney, the original creator, Kurt Wiebe, and Ed Loomis, leave the NSA. They take early retirement, and they leave so that they say they won't be involved in the criminal activity. Drake stays in and fights the good fight for another, from his point of view.
He was later indicted, Thomas Drake.
Binney, Wiebe, and Loomis, and Drake form a kind of group. They hadn't really, Drake hadn't known them, but they form a kind of group, a friendship around this. And they bring in a woman from Congress, another Republican conservative, Diane Rourke, who was on the staff of the Intelligence Committee. She too believes that Thin Thread was the right idea and that something really fishy is going on. And she personally breaks through the veil of secrecy around the program and pierces it and knows what it is and says the NSA has gone rogue and tries to turn Congress in the direction of forcing the administration to turn it off. She fails. The Thin Thread group fails. Drake fails. And when the New York Times runs their story and the vice president of the United States, in a fit of pique, not uncharacteristic about leaking, steps forward and the FBI jumps in and starts to find, is tasked to find the leakers of the information to the New York Times, the FBI lands on Drake, Binney, Wiebe, Rourke, believing they are the leakers to the New York Times. In fact, James Risen from the Times tells us in the film that they were not the leakers, but along the way they're raided by the FBI. Binney claims that he was in the shower and at gunpoint an FBI agent pulled the curtain back and said, "Get out, you know, step out here." That their houses were raided, their lives were more or less crushed, according to them. Ed Loomis says his wife left him in hysteria because of it. All of them felt the long arm of the law pressing them, as the FBI sometimes does as part of their playbook, to flip and turn one another in. Didn't occur. But Drake was the only one indicted. And when he was indicted, his case fell apart in the most amazing way. They had claimed under the Espionage Act that he possessed two top secret documents. In fact, they hired James Bamford, the great writer about the NSA, Puzzle Palace, etc. And Bamford, Drake's attorneys, public defenders, hired Bamford to examine the documents, and he found them on the web unclassified.
I remember this, yeah.
And that they were unclassified on the web because the government had put them there.
Right.
But what happened was, of course, they pulled the documents out of Drake's computer, looked at them, decided that they were, in fact, classified documents, ran a line through, which we show in the film, ran a line through the unclassified part, stamped it top secret, and charged him under the Espionage Act, for which he might have received as much as 35 years in prison.
And by then, we're in the Obama administration, right? By the time this is happening.
Exactly. I mean, Drake is indicted in the Bush administration. Yes, I think so.
I thought it was part of the when he was charged with espionage. I thought Obama was president by then. No?
It may be true. He's waiting for the indictment. That's probably true. And he's a supporter of Obama because he believes what Obama is saying, which is whistleblowers are valuable to the society. Obama, the candidate, says the whistleblowers are valuable to the society. Drake, another fellow named Tom Tam from the Justice Department, and all of the other Thin Thread people and Diane Rourke are all believers that Obama will probably back away from this. In fact, quite the opposite turns out to be true. Drake is indicted, and until his case falls apart, it looks to him like he may end up doing serious time for espionage.
And what did happen? We just need to wrap that up before the break, Michael. What happened to Thomas Drake?
Thomas Drake now works at a mall in Maryland, in an Apple store where he's works at the Genius Bar. So from the top level of the NSA, and then a whistleblower, and then an indicted person under the Espionage Act, uses up his retirement money, loses his real lawyers, goes to public defenders who become his real lawyers, and then now they plea bargains out the charge down to a $25 court fee and a year's community service, and ends up at an Apple store. There's certainly nothing wrong with that, but it's not where you think Tom Drake would be working now.
Michael Kirk, producer of part one of the two-part documentary United States of Secrets, which debuts on PBS's Frontline tomorrow night, May 13th. We'll take another break here, come back and speak more with Michael Kirk and also Michael Greenberger joining us today, director of the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security. You can reach us if you have a comment or question, 410-662-8780 for Midday. I meant to mention earlier that Michael Greenberger at the University of Maryland School of Law, the Carey School of Law, actually taught a class in the whole Snowden caper, right?
Right.
The leak of these documents and the ramifications of it.
Right.
So how did that class go?
It went very well. I originally was limiting the students to 25 students in the class. I had to raise that to 50.
Wow.
There was tremendous interest. We got a lot of interest from people at the NSA who wanted to come and talk to the class. There was a privacy board that was set up and got operating right after Snowden made the releases, and they did a very detailed report on the releases, their effectiveness, their lawfulness, and the executive director of that staff came in, and the students were really, really interested in it. One of the reasons is, Liz, it's very good to have a law course about something that's in the newspapers every day, and the story changes every day.
Yeah.
So the students really liked it a lot.
Did you discuss what President Obama has said about all this and proposed?
Well, I was going to say, and I think that's one of the things about the documentary makes clear, and I assume that the second part will make clear, that when he was a candidate, Obama thought this surveillance was just terrible, but he really, for whatever reason, came to endorse the most aggressive uses of this surveillance. He voted for one of the statutes that authorized this surveillance. Mm-hmm. And really, until his first reaction was very hostile towards Snowden, they were going to indict him.
I remember.
They're going to put him to jail forever.
Eric Holder
people were calling
well.
For the mm-hmm. death penalty. But in the wake of the public's response to this, Obama has backed away. You were talking about Dutch Rupertsberger, who's mm-hmm. a ranking member of the Intelligence Committee and one of our area's distinguished members of Congress. First, he thought it was wonderful. Then he backed away. And there is a consensus forming in Congress now that if they can work it through, I think, rationalizes this program in a way that brings it, if it's not constitutional, it'll be pretty darn close.
In the time remaining, Michael Kirk, I'd like to hear from you on that, too. What do you think about what Michael Greenberger just said, and how would you characterize the reaction in Congress?
Well, there were no profiles in courage in the first four or five years in our Congress. The Bush administration pulled in the Gang of Six, pulled in the leaders of the intelligence committees. Mike Hayden gave them a briefing. He's legendary for being an unbelievable briefer, and he tells us in the film that he went full Monty for the committee, telling them everything there was. The problem, as others point out, is that no one from their staffs were allowed to come to the meetings. They were not allowed to keep any notes. They were not allowed to tell their staff what they had been told by Cheney. And General Hayden, they, of course, don't have the legal expertise to know whether something is constitutional or unconstitutional, and they didn't have the technical expertise to know even what these guys were talking about when they're talking about metadata and a bulk collection. So you could imagine Nancy Pelosi and others being going back to their offices and sort of saying, I've just heard something. It seems real scary. I don't really know if it's bad or it's good, and I don't know how to decide whether it's bad or it's good. I can't talk to anybody about it. I can't raise any questions. I don't even know what questions to ask Hayden. So, and that was the sort of lead of what began for years with Congress. Now, if the Intelligence Committee people were not going to raise a stink, how was the congressman from Northern California going to make any trouble or get anywhere with it? That's part of this sense that the American people don't really care. You have to sort of understand, I think, or at least question how they heard what they heard, and the same is true with Congress. It's now, in the wake of Snowden, I think, beginning to hear things. The press itself is becoming more aggressive and maybe even more knowledgeable about this. Don't forget, the New York Times decided in 2004 not to run the story that they already had in hand.
Yeah, they held the story we were referring to earlier, actually was held for a year, right?
A year. Yeah. And during that year, the metadata and bulk collection grew. And in that time period, you know, many other things happened, and until Jim Risen, the reporter from the New York Times, decided to put what he knew about the program in a chapter called The Program in his book, and therefore held a gun to the head of the New York Times, for which they were not thrilled.
Right.
If it hadn't been for that, one wonders whether the Times would have run the story, certainly in that year while they waited. Much changed and much went on, and the ultimate payoff for the Times, of course, has been that Edward Snowden saw that and knew that from the record that he'd read sitting in Japan, and realized that the New York Times, from his point of view, was in the pocket of the government and was not to be trusted, and it was one of the main reasons he didn't give any documents to the New York Times.
Michael Kirk, we're short of time now, but one more question for you, Mike, and Michael Greenberger. What has changed in the last year in terms of the program and how it functions, or if it still functions? What has changed?
Well,
go ahead, Mike.
I would just say, you know, studying this, June 13th, 2013, Snowden makes the revelations.
Right.
From where I sit, the universe has really flipped on this Congress.
Do you think the NSA is still doing what it
shortly
was doing?
Shortly after the Snowden leaks, mm-hmm. the House of Representatives had a vote on whether to cut off funding to the NSA to do these things.
I remember that. That's
and
right.
They came within 7 votes. Yeah. Now, that wasn't all Democrats. It was the Tea Party and the progressives.
Right.
It's very hard to put a political alliance on this. Rand Paul's against it.
Right.
So I think you're seeing legislation now that's moving in a direction. Snowden, for better or for worse on what he did, has had a major impact on the thinking in the United States of America. That's my view.
And in terms of what's going on down there, no such agency, the NSA in Fort Meade, are they still capturing the same information they were capturing before?
They have made several concessions to Congress that will enable Congress to stop the bulk collection and go about this in a way that brings it more within traditional constitutional values.
Michael Greenberger, thanks for being here again today. I'm sorry we just ran out of time here. Excuse me. Michael Greenberger, in addition to being a professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law, is director of the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security and joins us from time to time here on Midday. And Michael Kirk, thank you very much for being on the show today. And we'll tell folks again that part one of the 2-part documentary, United States of Secrets, a frontline documentary, airs tomorrow night, May 13th, on PBS MPT in Maryland, and Part 2, May 20th, which deals with Silicon Valley and its connection to the government, airs May 20th, as I said. Michael Kirk, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay. And thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Michael Greenberger. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. That's our show for today. Enjoy the afternoon, and we'll see you again tomorrow.
Midday senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman in High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at wypr.org. Dan Rodrick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.
Here and Now is coming up next here on your NPR news station.